anybody has any questions, please feel free to do so. Yes.
I'd like to ask Arjun about how he develops the concentration through the different stages of jhana.
You may have actually read a lot or something about jhanas, however, the actual practice of developing it is just to put a lot of effort into developing concentration and really work at doing this through developing your mindfulness upon a meditation object. And you have to work hard at the practice, either in the walking, in the formal postures of walking or sitting. As you practice like this, you'll become more skillful at concentrating the mind. And so keeping your mindfulness focused upon a meditation object and being able to sustain it there and strengthen the mind like this, and over time, you'll find that the mind will achieve deeper degrees of concentration. However, when one achieves deeper degrees of concentration, there are no signposts, like when one is travelling down a road, saying that you've achieved this level of concentration, the first jhana, second jhana, or what have you. And so none of this is there, so it's important that you just keep on developing mindfulness and concentration. In the training of developing mindfulness and concentration, it's not that we can only do this in the formal postures of sitting or walking. We should endeavour to have mindfulness right from one's waking moment, and to have mindfulness watching over one's own mind. And whatever work and duties, actions, activities you're doing throughout the day, to mindfully do these. And then whenever there are even just short moments where you are free, then to bring your awareness to your meditation object, whether you're watching the breath coming in or going out, or reciting a meditation word such as Buddho, and to just to keep using your time like this so as a way to develop and strengthen your mindfulness and concentration. And looking at my own practice when I was in my early 20s, sometimes noticing when the mind was restlessly thinking a lot or was agitated, then in the wish to take control over the mind by developing mindfulness throughout the day. And then sometimes, say for example, if I was riding on a bus, I would, in my own language, say to play with the breath. And that was just, I just sit there, instead of talking to other people, I just watch the breath coming in and going out. And upon seeing that the mind had become quiet, then to stop watching the breath and just have mindfulness watching over the mind. And so this was the approach that I took to quieten the mind and to have mindfulness being in control of the mind. Whenever there is a slip of mindfulness, one can re-establish mindfulness just by stopping temporarily and focusing upon your breath, or for example the meditation word, and just keep returning to these and to re-establish mindfulness. Yes, please.
I have a question, but it's maybe a two-part question. When we read the Nikaya, to us householder, it is very encouraging that the Buddha said householder can achieve and attain Sotapanna on the way up to Anagami. So the two-part question is, in the long history of Dhamma in Thailand, has there been validated cases of householder who have attained Sotapanna or Anagami? And secondly, the question is, what would your advice be to householders who are very dedicated to achieve Sotapanna?
To attain to the first two levels, the first level of Sotapanna, the stream enterer, or the second level of Sagadagami, the once returner, there are, but it is still difficult because lay life, you have work duties and responsibilities, it makes it more difficult to go about the practice. And as for attaining to the level of Anagami, the non-returner, that's even harder. Normally, one has to be a renunciate or ordained, because that requires living a life of celibacy. However, the practice that is necessary to attain to any of these levels of Dhamma, to levels of enlightenment, is something that we should each be going about doing. Because the teaching of the Buddha is actually a teaching that he gave to humans and also to the devatas or celestial beings, always emphasizing that the practice was for the attainment of Dhamma right from the very first stage until the ultimate stage of attaining Nibbana. if one wishes to practice so as to achieve the first level of attainment of stream enterer, one can do this. What you need to have is you need to have this, make the sincere vow to always maintain the five moral precepts and to live your life in a way that you would not intentionally break any of the five moral precepts. The strength of sila or moral virtue alone is not sufficient to attain to the levels of enlightenment. Having sila as a foundation in your practice, you then need to develop concentration, and you need to concentrate the mind to the level where the mind is able to be one-pointed and you are able to maintain this peaceful focus of the mind throughout the day, maintain that strength of mind. Upon the practice of concentration, this gives rise to mindfulness and wisdom. It gives rise to wisdom. And so the path of practice for the attainment of Sotapanna, what in Pali is called the Arya Magga or the Noble Path, always has to be these three factors of sila, samadhi and panya, moral virtue, concentration and wisdom. They all three have to be functioning together. All three of these factors have to be present together. If you only have moral virtue and you have mindfulness or you have intelligence, that is still not sufficient because you require the strength of mind, which is obtained through concentration. If you have concentration but you have poor moral virtue, then also the mind is still not ripe enough or strong enough to attain to the Dhamma. All three have to be present. The attainment of stream entry, it lets go of the coarsest portion of the mental defilements. The defiling emotion of greed is weakened due to the fact that one keeping these moral precepts, one will be content with the things that one has. One would not break any precept to get anything or act upon greed. Likewise with anger, the coarsest aspects of anger, like ill will and vengeance, these have been completely let go of from the mind, and anger is expressed in a form of displeasure. And so these emotions have been weakened but not completely let go of. To make that transformation from being an unenlightened person to being enlightened, even at the first stage of Sotapanna, then one has to change one's view from wrong view to right view. And this is obtained through coming about developing contemplation, right theme of contemplation. It's necessary that you have to start both contemplating the body, to reflect upon one's own body, to see that it is merely comprised of these four primary elements of earth, water, air and fire that come together temporarily, and it's their nature to ultimately break apart. And so you'll see that the body is impermanent and absent of self. And if one sees this frequently, then one will begin to let go of one's attachment and identification of the body, until ultimately letting go of one portion of attachment out of the first three stages of enlightenment are bound to the body. And so the attainment of Sotapanna, letting go of the first portion of attachment to the body, that is the attainment of Sotapanna. For unenlightened people, they have great attachment towards their body. And so when the body is afflicted by sickness, this will be a source of suffering for them. Or as the body ages and goes through the changes in one's life, this will always be a source of suffering for us. And likewise, when faced with death, this will be a source of alarm for the mind, and this will also be a source of suffering for an unenlightened person. However, the practice is said to attain to this level, first, at least the first level of enlightenment, of stream entry, is this practice of moral virtue, concentration and wisdom. Moral virtue is a foundation upon which we establish concentration. Concentration gives rise to mindfulness and wisdom. And with mindfulness and wisdom, frequently contemplating the body to see the impermanence and absence of self of the body, then attachment and identification towards the body begins to weaken, until ultimately letting go one portion of attachment towards the body. And when one attains to the level of stream entry, then when sickness afflicts the body, this will not be a source of suffering for the mind. Likewise, as we're about to experience death, this will not alarm the mind in any way or shake one that person. When we develop this right view and we're able to let go of the attachment towards the body, we will begin to see that the mind and the body are not one and the same thing. And so through seeing this letting go of attachment towards the body, we weaken the defiling emotion of greed and anger. Anger is also weakened as well. It is said for the stream enterer that there will be no eighth rebirth. There will be at most only seven more rebirths remaining. However, if they're practicing intensely, then at the most they would have three more rebirths. But if their practice is very intensive, then they would only take on one more rebirth, and their future rebirths will always be in the realm of in the human realm or in the Devata realm. To further develop the practice to the second level of enlightenment, that of Sagadagami, or the once returner, one continues with the same path of practice, moral virtue, concentration and wisdom, reflecting upon the body once again and reflecting upon the mind to see the impermanence and absence of self of both the body and mind. And as one sees this more and more clearly, then the attachment towards the body and the mind weakens even further. It's not so difficult, really. It starts with this intention to always maintain these five moral precepts, never having the intention to transgress any of the moral precepts. And keeping the moral precepts, then try to develop concentration every day, develop a meditation practice. And this will give rise to mindfulness and wisdom. And this is the wisdom faculty which will enable you to reflect upon the body, to see that the body is impermanent and absent of self, and gradually let go of your attachment towards the body. So just giving you a rough overall explanation of this, is this enough for you to understand? Sorry.
In Mahasatipatthana Sutta, Buddha has given four nupassanas, which in the body, the kaya nupassanas, vedana, citta, and dhamma. Are they supposed to be practiced one by one, or all together at the same time? So can one proceed to vedana nupassana before completing kaya nupassana?
You have to remember that these four foundations of mindfulness, these four satipatthana, this is like a scriptural description. You can actually narrow this down even to just being the body and the mind. So it's important to narrow it down first to body and mind. With the body, you can contemplate both the body and also the vedana, or the feeling of the body. And with the mind, you can contemplate the feeling of the mind, the feeling aspect of the mind, and also the citta, which is also the heart or the mind, and the dhamma. And so it narrows down to just these two. So for now, to put down what you've read, to put this aside, and to apply the practice whenever greed or anger, satisfaction and dissatisfaction arise within your heart, to focus upon these, to watch your mind, and find a means to let these go from your heart. Having watched the mind and been able to reflect upon the thoughts and emotions and made the mind free from thoughts and emotions, then being free, you'll be able to take up the body for contemplation, to see the impermanence and absence of self of the body. If you have painful feelings arising upon the body, then likewise you can also turn to them, use your mindfulness and wisdom to reflect upon these, to see their impermanence and absence of self. So this is just like a very brief explanation of how to practice with the four satipatthana. So you will see that it's not necessary to think that you have to do each particular foundation of mindfulness of these four. Just to keep a watch over your mind, have your mindfulness and wisdom keeping a watch over the mind. Whenever any moods and emotions arise, to let them go from the mind. Once the mind is free from these, then to take up the body for reflection. And so this is how you're always working within this domain of these four satipatthana. When painful feeling arises, also to reflect upon that, to see the impermanence and absence of self of this. And in this way, you're always working with the four satipatthana. Yes, there was a lady over there.
My question is about the first and the last precept. just some clarification. So the first precept says, do not kill. And then my understanding is if the animal or fish or meat or whatever is not killed for you, it is okay to consume. Is that right? Because if you just go and buy in the shop, is it okay to consume like that as long as it's not killed for you? And the last precept of intoxicants, if you take a social drink, so where you're not sort of harming anybody, as long as you're not intoxicated and driving or hurting anyone, is that acceptable?
The first precept of not taking life, if you purchase meat or fish, and which has already been killed, and purchase it in the market, then that's okay. That's not a breaking of the precept in any way. However, the fifth precept, partaking in intoxicating drinks, even if it's just a social drink, then that is still considered to be a break of the fifth precept. And so you have to make a choice with that, whether you keep that precept or not. In keeping the precepts, for example, the first precept, it's important to think that all beings, whether human or animal, every being has a mother, a father, brothers and sisters, and all beings within that bond, there is a bond with each other. They love each other. Each being cherishes their own life, wishes for happiness, doesn't wish for unhappiness or to have their life taken. And so we should always remember that even animals love their own life, and their only difference from us is one main difference is that they don't speak our language, but they love life. Coming overseas, I often see people that like to fish for sport, and they just see them along the coastline in different places, and I sometimes think, how would they feel if they had a hook going to their mouth? You know, it must be painful to have this going into the mouth, and so if they could put a hook through their mouth and not experience any pain, then go ahead, just keep on fishing. And so, with regards to meat and fish, there are plenty of people in the world who are quite prepared to have occupations. That's their nature, where they will kill animals, and so just purchase meat or fish which has already been killed and is available in the markets or supermarkets. With the fifth precept, talking about intoxicants and drugs, then it's better not to partake of alcohol. Many people have the potential to live until they're 70, 80 or 90. However, we seem to like to go about and harm ourselves. And so if you drink alcohol, which can cause cirrhosis of the liver or even liver cancer, and or say, for example, our lungs are very well protected in the rib cage, and yet we like to smoke. And so this can cause cancer or emphysema, different conditions. And so it seems like nobody will come and harm us. We just like to harm ourselves through these things. And so if you think that any of these, you have to use your money, and so they use your money, they damage your health. So it's better just to make better use of your body and to abstain from these things. Yes, please.
Thank you so much for coming. Could you tell me about a little bit about your teacher, Ajahn Chah?
Venerable Ajahn Chah, he was my preceptor, which means he ordained me. And I ordained 35 years ago in a period where his health was still strong and he was still teaching. He is a monk who had a lot of metta, goodwill, loving kindness, and also a lot of wisdom. He's a very good teacher, and he was a very good role model for his students as well. And even if I only get 50% of his qualities, it would still be good. People going to study with him had to be smart or have your own wisdom, because he taught in a way where you had to keep your eyes and ears open and just observe and listen and learn that way. I lived with him at Wat Nong Bapong for three cold seasons over a 3-year period, and just in the cold season. And so there were times where he would give teachings, or his teachings were less frequent. If his health wasn't so good, sometimes it may be 2 to 3 months before you would hear a formal teaching. However, we were always receiving teachings just by seeing him, his behavior in the monastery, how he his deportment and how he carried himself, and also just reflecting upon the rules, regulations, and observances that were laid down in his monastery, and how it created a sense of harmony and peacefulness in the monastery for 50 to 60 monks to live there, and also 40 or 50 nuns were living there as well, and the place is very peaceful. And so just to reflect about what he'd actually done or was doing there. In his monastery, in the evening time, between about 6 or 7 o'clock, he would often be sitting at his kuti, at his dwelling, his hut, and monks were able to go there and approach him if they had any business, or just go and sit and listen there to kind of like miscellaneous points of Dhamma or business that was happening within the monastery. And one evening when I went along there, I heard him just say something very short, but it really, really impressed me. And he was saying that for people, it's so difficult to change their conceited views and opinions. It's something which is really difficult to do. And for some people, their attachment to their own views and opinions, even if they're wrong, they'll still hold on to them for their entire life. And he further went on to say that to blow up a mountain, to turn it just into rubble or into dust, you can take a big mountain and it gradually blow it up, and over 5 to 10 years, and nothing will remain, or just be dust. However, the views and opinions of some people, you can try for your entire life to change them, and they will never change. They will never let go of their hold that they have on their wrong views and opinions. Therefore, you can really see the great importance of right view. It's like taking the right turn on a road, and then you go the right way, your practice will go correctly. If you take the wrong turn, then you just keep going off. You just make a detour, and you're just always on a detour. He had many, many ways of teaching, and sometimes it would seem like his teaching, he was just teaching in very gentle, mild ways, but they were also could be very, sometimes his teaching could also be quite strong and intense. I can remember one evening going to his hut at around 5 or 6 in the evening, and there was 4 or 5 other monks there, and he was just about to go off on a walk on a tour of the monastery to have a look around. And as he approached the eating hall, which was just a simple hall made of iron sheets back in those days, at the end of the hall there was some ice boxes or ice coolers, these ones for storing ice and cold drinks. And they had still had cold coffee stains on them. They had not, and so when he saw these, as he was walking along, and you must remember he was about 60 at this time and walking with a walking stick, when he saw all of these, he picked up his walking stick and just struck them all, and they all went rolling away. And he says, "What is it with these monks? They drink. They know how to drink it, but they don't know how to clean things." And so the monks that were with him, they rushed off, picked them all up and washed them and everything. And he just went on to say, you know, 40 or 50 monks come and have a drink, but then they don't take, you know, you have a drink, but then you don't wash it. And then just walking away from there, just a few steps, the conversation completely changed. And it was on another topic. It was like it never arose at all. And as we walked off around the monastery, he never returned to that topic again. And you get to see that for the mind of a fully enlightened being, an arahant, that the mind is in the present moment. And so when things arise, and then they cease, and when they cease, they cease, and they just don't keep coming up again. And it was a clear example of this. However, to look at the situation, it can be quite difficult for somebody who looked at it incorrectly. They would see him expressing what would look like anger by striking these things, and so that would be looking at the whole situation in the wrong way. For example, if it was me at my monastery and I saw that, I would just make a verbal comment to the people, why have you left all of these here? Why have you not cleaned them? But it was his nature, his character upon seeing these, that when he saw them, he expressed it in that way, and the monks knew what he meant. And so the character of each person can be very different in how they go about expressing. And so he had many ways of teaching. With some people, he'd speak very nicely and gently, and with other people, he could be quite strong and scolding or fierce. However, I only lived with him for 3 cold seasons, and in the whole time I lived with him, I never criticized him in any way whatsoever, and he was always somebody that I sort of held great esteem for and elevated. Though, just to explain this quite shortly, he taught in many, many ways, actually. Yes, please.
I think you answered a lot of my questions before I even asked them. But could you comment on how we let go of that anger when somebody has approached us, even in their own way, which happens so often in society these days? Yes, coming to the present, but how do we and accept them for who they are without judgment?
You have to practice concentration so that you have mindfulness. You develop the strength of mindfulness so that your mindfulness is wise to the emotions, or it's abreast of the emotions as they arise. If you do have the strength of mindfulness, which is abreast of any emotions when they arise, say for example you have anger or dissatisfaction arises in your heart, then your mindfulness is fast enough to actually see, okay, this has arisen. How am I going to let go of this? Anger can arise in different ways. Say, for example, somebody approaches us and they may say something displeasing to us or criticize us. And if you're mindful, you can listen to what they're saying, and then you can actually reflect what they're saying. Is it true or not? Have I done something wrong, actually? And if you have, then you have to think. You have to be thankful to that person and think, okay, I'll go about correcting myself, changing whatever was wrong. So you have to train to be quite sort of open-hearted or broad-minded, and if anything like this happens, rather than being angry towards them, to actually thank them, especially if you are in the wrong and there is something which you have to improve upon. Even if you are not in the wrong, however, due to our personal conceit and our opinions, our attachment to these, sometimes when people come and say things to us which we don't like, this still gives rise to anger, even though that we don't like this. And so we're still in the wrong. And so you still have to be working with that as well. For example, in that situation, somebody comes and says something to you and you realize that you're not in the wrong. If it's somebody close to you, a friend or a relation, you actually have time to communicate with them, you can actually explain to them what has happened, why it's happened. And so it's a means to actually for them to lessen their anger, and for you to not get angry as well, because you're correcting the situation. That's why we always have to have mindfulness and wisdom watching over our mind. Try not to allow any defiling emotions or any suffering arise within them. And if they do, we have to find a means to let them go as quickly as we possibly can, and not keep a hold of these. If throughout the day you always have this practice of trying to have metta, goodwill, friendliness and loving kindness within your heart, then this is a skillful means to actually counter the emotion of anger. And so this is a way that you can deal with this. Just try to have this as a part of your life throughout your day. When I myself was 16 or 17, I saw 2 of my friends get into quite a heated argument, and I could see by their facial expressions and their body language that there was actually quite a lot of suffering for them. And just seeing this, I actually made a vow to myself that I'm going to make every effort to try and not have any anger within my own heart, to actually abandon anger from the mind. You have to have this right view to see that anger is a source of suffering, it's not a source of happiness. And so when you see that, then you'll have this intention to try and work with this, to try and find means, methods to abandon it, not to allow it to arise within the mind, or if it does arise, to find any means that you can to abandon it from the mind as soon as it arises, as soon as you possibly can. And it's not that one does not have any kilesa, any mental defilement. It's just that when they do arise, when say for example anger, when it does arise, then you have to be patient, you have to endure, and you have to find a way to let it go as soon as you can. For most people who are lacking in mindfulness and wisdom, then when their mind is overcome by these, say for example by the emotion of anger, then they will express it. First they will come out by speech, and they will argue, and then it can progress to they will physically harm each other, and at the very extreme then people will kill each other due to anger. And that is all due to a lack of mindfulness and wisdom. That is why we have to practice concentration, so that you develop the strength of mindfulness, so that one can keep control over the mind, so that the mind will only think in good, wholesome ways, and as a consequence, one will therefore act and speak in wholesome ways too. Within our hearts, quite often, we have bad thoughts arising, but it's not necessary that we have to speak and act upon them. Yet for anyone who is lacking in mindfulness or wisdom, then whenever they have these bad thoughts, then they speak and then they act upon them. Some people, they just speak upon everything that they're thinking, but it's not necessary. Therefore, you need to have this mindfulness and this wisdom to actually think before you speak. It's not necessary to speak everything that you think. And so, reflecting like this, you think, is it appropriate to say, to speak upon this particular emotion, this particular feeling that you have? If it is, you speak. If it's not, then you have to endure with this. Yes, please.
I have a question. My question is about the emotion of love and detachment and attachment. So I recognize the detachment of self and the one-pointedness, and where I seem to have a misunderstanding is, yes, as a mother, in my case, my duty is my loving duty and wanting to my family. There's such an attachment there, and there's such love. Are we to be working towards detaching from that sense of a love attachment? But responsibly, not irresponsibly, so that in your practice you're sort of losing your sense of self intentionally, but yet there's still such a strong attachment to your family.
It's natural for anybody who is a parent, a mother or a father, they have this very strong connection, this bind with their children. And so you go about performing your role as a parent, as best as you can. And if, say for example, if your children are doing anything wrong, or you feel that there is something which you need to give them some instruction or admonishment about, then you go about, you do that as you feel is necessary. And if you've done that and they do what you say, that is good. If they don't do what you say, then sometimes that is when you have to learn to have this quality of equanimity or detaching yourself, because you've tried to be of assistance to them, but if they're not ready to accept that assistance or follow it, then sometimes you just have to detach yourself and have this equanimity towards your children.
It wasn't so much that as just this overabundance of love. It had really nothing to do with discipline or admonishing. It was more just, I guess, just this pure sense of love and being together in a united way.
Once again, it's purely natural that a parent feels this love for their children. However, you must also be reflecting all the time, contemplating upon the true nature of your own body, to mm-hmm. see that your body is a temporary phenomena. And that one day it will die, it will break down and die. Also, your children are of the same nature. Mm-hmm. One day or another, their bodies will also, they'll go through that process and ultimately die. And so you will actually realize that everybody that is born must go through this process of death, which means separation from each other as well. So one day, you must meet with separation. Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering, why is it necessary to realize that mind and body are distinct in order to become happy? And what is that like or how does one come to realize that?
It is important. It is important to change this wrong view and to correct you to see that the body and the mind are separate entities, because if you use your mind to reflect upon the nature of the body, as we've been saying, you will see, for example, when the body experiences sickness and you realize that you have completely no command, you cannot tell the body to be healthy, or as you're getting older, you're unable to tell the body to be youthful. Likewise, as the body is about to break down and die, you cannot tell the body to remain on longer. And if one is still strongly attached to the body, then this will be a source of suffering for one, because it's completely out of your control. And so that is why you have to reflect upon the true nature of the body, to see its impermanence and absence of self, so that you can let go of this attachment. And so for one that clearly sees that the mind is not the body, then when the body is afflicted with sickness or is about to die, then this will not be a source of suffering for this person, and the mind will not be shaken or disturbed at the time of death, because they already realize that it's the nature of the body to go this way, and that the mind is just merely a temporary resident within the body, just making use of it for the course of a lifetime. For anyone who has attained to any of the levels of attainment, whether it be the first level of stream enterer, the second of the once returner, the third level of non-returner, or a fully enlightened being, an arahant, then for anyone who has attained to any of these levels, even if one is a householder, if your wife or husband, your mother, father, or your children were to die, it would not be a source of suffering for you, because you know clearly already that this is truly nature happening, and it's their nature. Yet for an unenlightened person, when one's mother, father, brother, sister, or wife or husband, if they die and they're separate, and we meet with this separation, it's always a source of tremendous suffering for that person. And yet for one who has attained to the Dhamma, then they are mindfully aware at the moment of death, or seeing somebody else that has died, that they know that this is the true nature of the body, that it's an impermanent phenomena. It's born, it exists for a while, and then it dies. And so this does not perturb the mind in any way whatsoever. They know that there's this saying that you understand death before death comes, or you see the breaking apart of the body before it actually breaks apart. You clearly and deeply understand this already. Yet for a person who has attained to these levels of enlightenment, out of their good-naturedness, their metta, they may have feelings of, they reflect upon this person and ask themselves, has this person performed enough goodness in their life? And if they haven't, then they may feel, well, it's a shame for them that they never really got to do what they really should have done. And once again, for a person who has attained to any of these four levels of enlightenment, when it comes to the death of their own body, then this is not a source of suffering for them, because they clearly understand that this is the nature of the body, that it must break apart. Because you could say that their mind already has a destination to go to, and they know where it's going to.
Yes. Is mind and consciousness the same?
Beg your pardon?
Mind and consciousness, is this the same or different?
For unenlightened people, or beings still at who are not at the final stage of full enlightenment, then the mind and consciousness I consider to be one and the same thing, because the mind, out of delusion, attaches to consciousness, believing it to be the mind. Whereas for an arahant, the mind is outside of the consciousness. Or they truly know that consciousness is just a function of the mind. It's not the mind. It's an activity. Yes, please.
Going back to the mind-body division, is it the mind Interesting. You link with your body. When we feel stress, we feel it in the body. When we have emotion like anger, we feel it in the body. So isn't there a direct relationship between the body and the mind?
Yes, there is a connection. The mind does have an effect on the body, or the body can have an effect on the mind. And so, because due to a person's past actions, their karma, you take rebirth. And so the mind takes rebirth into a body. And so we have rebirth into a body. And it's with this wrong view that we attach to the body as being oneself. And so it's necessary that one needs to have this right view to see that the body is just comprised of these elements, and that the body is born, it exists, and it dies. To have this, develop this attitude or this correct viewing of the body to see its true nature as being like that. The mind, it moves throughout the body, and as we experience things in the body and we're aware of these, then with this delusion we perceive this as being oneself. There's this attachment taking place towards the body. Say if one were to reflect upon the body, if you breathe out but do not breathe in, or you breathe in and do not breathe out, then the heart, it will stop beating. At that time, when the heart stops beating, the air element no longer comes into the body. And when the air element no longer comes in, then the heat element is also extinguished in the body. And you will probably hear of people saying that dead bodies are cool, because the heat element, it evaporates, it's gone from the body. The water element in the body, after death, about 3 or 5 days, then the body starts to bloat, and the water elements in the body start to search for a way to seep out of the body, and whether it's blood, pus, or other liquids in the body, they start to seep out, and they return back to the earth. Likewise, the earth element of the body, that which is hard, whether it's bones, teeth, nails, skin and what have you, these things, they break apart, and whether it's 5, 10, or even up to 100 years, ultimately they will all return back to the earth, all of these elements. And upon death, the mind leaves the body, and whatever happens to the body after that, whether they burn the body or put it in a refrigerator or anything, you actually have no awareness of that heat or that cold anymore. We must contemplate upon the body like this, not so as to give rise to fear, but to realize the truth about the body, and not to be careless or heedless about how we live. And so if one was to reflect, like, everybody in this room, where are we all going to? Everybody in this room ultimately is traveling towards death. There is nobody in this room that can escape death. And you do not reflect like this in a morbid way to give rise to fear. We do this so as to give rise to heedfulness in our life, because we've taken these elements, we've received these elements from our parents, and so we must make good use of them by the practice of generosity, keeping moral virtue, developing concentration, and cultivating our minds, always working to develop ourselves more and more, and being heedful in how we make use of this body and develop our lives. For everybody has performed good and bad actions in their lives or in past lives. And yet when the fruit of our good actions enables us to be reborn as a human, then it's necessary that we have to keep on extending this goodness, developing more goodness in our lives. For many people, being born as a human, then throughout their life, they develop themselves wholesomely. They develop this practice of having generosity, keeping moral virtue, developing concentration, and developing wisdom in their heart. And if upon the time of death they have not finished their spiritual practice, then there will be rebirth in the future. And you can say what they've done in their life, that is their profit or their gain. And even if one were not to believe in rebirth, then there's still goodness of theirs. It's a life well led. However, for anybody who lives a life immorally, does bad things, then upon the time of death, then it's been a complete loss for them, really, their life. Some people do actually believe that there may not be life after death. There is no rebirth. And And so if they live their life in unskillful or unwholesome ways, then even in the present life, there will still be discontent and suffering arising in their life. However, for those who develop themselves in skillful and wholesome ways, then even in this present life, even if there were not a future life, they're still experiencing happiness and wholesomeness in the present. Therefore, having taken birth as a human, we should not let our days go by in vain, our time go by in vain. We must always be working to develop ourselves by practicing generosity, practicing moral virtue, concentration, and wisdom.
If someone dies violently and suddenly, who, I will say, in this particular case, is very young, 17, who drowns. I'll say, in this particular case, is someone who is highly developed, even though he was only 17. What happens there in the separation of mind from body, and can we help in any way?
When that people die at a young age, it's said like karma, their past actions come in quickly and intervene in their life. And so that's why people can lose their life at quite young ages, whether it's through sickness or accidents. And at the time of death, if that person has done good things in their life, then at the time of death, there is a vision, a nimitta, it's called a nimitta, or a vision arises. And if one has done a lot of good things, then this is a good vision, and the mind moves towards that, and that will take the mind on to a fortunate rebirth. If it's if they've done bad things, then it's not a good nimitta, and that takes the mind off to an unfavorable rebirth. Just relating a story which happened in Thailand of a young person who lived by the Chao Phraya River, the main river which flows through Bangkok. This person was only in their early 20s, but often used to go and offer food to the monks and go to the monastery and was practicing Dhamma. And one day when they went home, their house being right beside the river, they fell into the river and then got stuck in a log which was by the river, and they drowned. And because as they were dying, when this kamma, nimitta arose, what I'm saying, it was a good one, then the mind takes a hold of that, and that's which leads the mind on to a good or favorable rebirth. And so whether anybody wants to believe in this or not, it's up to them. That's why we shouldn't be careless or heedless in how we live our lives or how we approach life, because some people can die at quite young ages due to accidents or illness, and so we shouldn't go thinking that we're all going to live to be 70 or 80. Death can come at any time. It's like everybody in this room here has experienced life to quite a great deal already, experienced both happiness and suffering. However, there's nobody here that would have experienced proper, true happiness, because the happiness which we derive through seeking out happiness through our sensory pleasures or through material objects, it's merely a very fleeting or temporary happiness which just covers over any discontent or unhappiness which we have in our lives. But it's not true happiness, because true happiness is when we do things which the doing of things for the lessening and eventual abandoning of the mental defilements of greed, anger and delusion. It is this which leads to true happiness. Therefore, the way of practice or the way of life to achieve or experience true happiness is through the development of all that is good, developing goodness to the utmost, through the development of moral virtue, concentration and wisdom. By following this path, this is the path which leads to true happiness. Therefore, all of you have this intention to develop yourselves, and so it's necessary then that you must just be patient, endure and put forth effort, and just keep going about this practice by endeavouring to keep developing oneself and cultivating oneself in this practice. Then with moral virtue, one's bodily actions and speech become peaceful. With concentration, the mind becomes peaceful. And with wisdom arising, there is even greater or true peacefulness arising as the mental defilements are gradually abandoned from the mind. So if we just look at things quite simply, any action which would be a source of bother or trouble or harmful to either oneself, to other beings, or to society in general, then one should always endeavour not to perform such actions. And whatever actions, wholesome actions, which are a source of happiness for not only oneself, for other people, and are beneficial to society in general, then to perform these actions.
This while we're on the subject of death, I recently read the autobiography of Arjun Bun, and following on from that with regard to Arjun Shah as well, that as enlightened beings, when they were cremated and the bones from that were collected, then there's this phenomenon of relics that seem to occur. Now, is that as a result of being an enlightened being that happens? And I was wondering if Arjun could comment on that as to why that kind of phenomena happens.
One of the amazing things which can happen for fully enlightened beings when their bodies are cremated is that the bones, as you mentioned, turn into very clear relics, unlike other bones of ordinary people. There are these very clear relics, and this is due to the fact that throughout their practice of continually reflecting upon their body and the mind and achieving this level of purity, that once their mind has been made pure, then this purity of mind, as it's always within the body, working through the body, it's like it cleanses the elements within the body. And so when the body is eventually cremated, then it happens that the bones often come together in these like crystalline forms or relics. When our clothing is dirty or soiled, we have to wash it with detergents. And when the mind is dirty, soiled or defiled, then we have to cleanse this through the practice of moral virtue, concentration and wisdom. Once the mind has been made pure, then the mind, still existing within the body, functioning within the body, that also cleanses the physical elements which are also in the body, and that is why it gives rise to these relics. It is true that there is this phenomena of relics. It does happen. However, in Thailand, you often find it's not given a great deal of importance, because the greatest importance is given to one's own practice in abandoning greed and anger and suffering from one's own heart. That is the process of purifying one's own heart. Last year, on the 30th of June, there was a ceremony at my monastery for the enshrining of Buddha relics and Arahant relics in a stupa that is being built at my monastery. There's a small hill and in the grounds at the back of my monastery. It's about maybe 20 meters high, the hill, and there's a stupa still being built on that, but the enshrinement ceremony took place last year. And before the ceremony, or even on the day of the ceremony, it's quite amazing that relics did manifest by themselves at that time. And so, but all of the relics were enshrined in the stupa, whether Buddha relics, Arahants of old, or Arahants of more modern times. All their relics that we had were all enshrined into the stupa. It is true, and it's quite amazing that this can actually happen to the body of a fully enlightened being. And the extent to which the amount of relics will often depend upon the length of time that a person was an Arahant, fully enlightened, before their death. Some attain full enlightenment at quite a young age. Say, in more recent times, the Venerable Ajahn Mahabua, in his biography, he would have attained to full enlightenment about at the age of 40, and he died when he was 97. And so, like, you've got a period there of more than 50 years where you have a pure mind still residing within the body. And so at his cremation, then, or even before the cremation, his hair would turn to relics, his nails would also turn to relics, and at the time of cremation, his bones turned into these crystalline relics, and also the liquids within his body, which had been taken out of his body at different times, blood, pus, and different things. All these things have turned into like these crystalline relics, and so you can see the effect, this amazing effect that a pure mind can have upon the material elements of the body. Ajahn Mahabhor, he was a disciple of Ajahn Mun's. I myself have absolutely no doubts about the validity of such things as this. A few years ago, there was an instance at my own monastery. I was receiving guests after the meal, and in clear daylight at about 10 o'clock, on the table in front of me, I had my offering cloth placed out there. Just this bright light manifested into the sala and just went down onto the offering cloth. And one of the lay people says, what's that? What's that on the offering cloth? And so I had a closer look at it, and there was a relic manifested on there, the size of the nail on the small finger, and it's an arahant relic from the Venerable Siwali, who was a disciple of the Lord Buddha. And so it's a very strange phenomenon, this, but it does happen. And so that particular relic, that was also enshrined in my chedi, which is being built. And just before the enshrining ceremony, there were five more which turned up, but it's most likely they were Buddha relics. Maybe sort of getting a bit too outside on the periphery of things here, because then it can start creating all kinds of doubts and suspicions in people's minds.